My guess is that many of us at some point in our lives have asked the question. It may have been the day after the funeral of a loved one. It's a question that many young people in the area will be maybe thinking about or asking in the next few months as they will graduate from high school or college. Maybe it's the question that a mom and dad struggle with when they drop off their child at college and they're dealing with the empty nest for the first time. Or maybe it is the retiree the day after the great retirement dinner and the going away party. I think many of us have dealt with the question of what now? What next? Well, we've gone through a transition, a loss, a heartache, a mistake sometimes, whatever it may be that's in our past. And as we're trying to think about the future, we've asked the question, what now? Where do we go from here? What happens next? Is there hope? How are things going to change? How am I going to deal with the change? What's going to happen next? As we think about what now, I want us to look, if you'd just allow me to have one last evening, for one last look at the Gospel of John. John chapter 21 and what Jesus does with the apostles. John 21 is one of my favorite places in all of the New Testament because it's a place about starting over. It's a place about transitions. You may remember several years ago we looked at John 21 as we thought about the idea of here we go again. And so I just didn't want to finish John without thinking for a few moments about what's happening here. Because I think it applies to so many places in life. Because life is filled with transitions. And there's been a lot of research done on transitions and books written. I remember a textbook or two along the way in psychology classes about this thing called transitions and that the health of the personality, the health of the person often lies in how they handle transitions in life. Transitions such as graduation, as marriage, the first child, the child going away to school, etc. And I think what we see in John 21 is we see some folks dealing with transition. In John 21 and verse 1, it says, "And after these things, Jesus manifested Himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. And He manifested Himself in this way. Simon Peter and Thomas called Didymus and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee and the sons of Zebedee and two others of His disciples were together. And Simon Peter said to them, 'I am going fishing.' And they said, 'We will also come with you.' They went out and got into the boat, and that night they caught nothing." What I want us to think about is what's happening as seven men are struggling with transition. And they've handled the transition, or attempting to do so, by going back to that which is comfortable. Jesus has died on the cross. Jesus has been resurrected. They have seen Him again. He has appeared to them already at least twice. And so now they're struggling with what now? Okay, they've had to rethink everything they thought they knew. They're still struggling with what's going to go on. I mean, we can go to Acts chapter 1, even as Jesus is nearing His ascension back into heaven. They're saying, "Is now the time you're going to restore the kingdom to Israel?" They still don't completely understand what's going to happen now. And so they go back to what's comfortable. A lot of times when we don't know what to do, we do what feels comfortable, what we've always done, what's our routine. And so they go back to their routine because so many of them came from around Galilee and so many of them were fishermen. My biblical bullseye, as I just think about what Jesus is doing in their lives, is same song, second verse. And I want to throw two darts at that are very simple. Repetition and recommission. Repetition and recommission. As we think about the repetition, you have a couple of repetitions here. You have the repetition of a miracle and the repetition of a question. And Jesus is going to use those two things to recommission the apostles. He's going to help them to know what they do next. Now, they've been fishing all night. They haven't had any success. They favored fishing at night. That's when they often felt they had the best success. But as the sun comes up in the morning here on the shores of Galilee, they haven't caught anything. And the text tells us that Jesus was walking on the shoreline, though at first they don't realize who He is. In verse 5 it says, "Children, you don't have any fish, do you?" And He words it as if He doesn't expect a positive answer. He knows they haven't caught any fish. They answered no. He says, "Cast the net on the right-hand side of the boat, and you will find a catch." And the text says that they obeyed Him. Again, it's interesting. They don't seem at this point to know exactly who He is. But every good fisherman is willing to try any advice. Who knows, maybe that new lure will be just what we need to catch what we've been after. So when He says, "Try the other side of the boat," they say, "Oh well, what can it hurt?" They do so, and it says the net is so filled with fish that they cannot lift it up out of the water. John seems to ever be the perceptive one in the group. And John realizes what's going on here. And maybe it's because John remembers something. Maybe he remembers what we find recorded in Luke chapter 5, verses 1 through 11. Another day, and maybe this same boat on this same sea, along this same shoreline, when Peter and Andrew, James and John are fishing, and along comes Jesus. And again, they've had no success, and He says, "Cast your nets on the other side." They do so. They have a great catch. And when they come to shore, Jesus says, "Come and I will make you fishers of men." So maybe as they are trying desperately to pull up the net full of fish, in just a few moments, John's going to say that we counted the fish. He doesn't say it that way, but he does say there were 153 in the net. So I'm assuming at some point when they got it on the shore, they said, "Let's see exactly how many we have." But somewhere it seems in that process, John puts two and two together, and the echo of that previous miracle can be heard in his mind, and he says to Peter, "It's the Lord." Now, Peter was stripped down for fishing. Okay, when you're out fishing in a boat all night or in the day, you don't dress the same way that you would when you're running around in town or maybe going to a service at the synagogue as they were growing up as Jews or a gathering of the church. And so the text says that he was in his work clothes, if you will. And so he's going to jump into the sea, but first he puts on his outer garment and he dives in the sea. Why is he doing that? I think the reason he does it is he wants to get to Jesus. I want you to think about the burdens these men bring to this fishing trip. Jesus had told them, "You will forsake me," and they did. When the chips were down that night in the garden, when they realized there was no way to stop the arrest of Jesus, they fled. And with the exception of John and a few women, most of his followers were not to be seen or stood off at a great distance. Peter himself had thrice denied Jesus, even to the point of cursing. These men bring a lot of guilt with them. Jesus is resurrected, but I think they're still struggling with what they did. They're dealing with the past and the certainty of what they did wrong, and the future and the uncertainty that lies there of what they do next. I think Peter desperately wanted to make things right with Jesus. And so I think when he found out Jesus was on the shoreline, he wasn't waiting for the boats to row in. He didn't care about the fish anymore. He wanted to see his Lord. So you can decide for yourself why you think he did it. My belief is he dove into the water so he could swim to the shore and see Jesus. And that's exactly what he did. Now, I want you to think about all that's happening in the story. I find myself saying, because some folks will say, okay, they've misplaced this miracle. You know, Luke puts it early in the ministry and John puts it at the end, and that's evidence that, you know, the gospel writers aren't accurate in their telling of events. Well, I believe they both have it exactly where the miracles happened. I believe there's a reason that it was in Luke chapter 5, and there's a reason that it's again here in John chapter 21. Because you've got a group of men who don't know what to do next, and so they've gone back to the life they knew before they were called by Jesus. What now? What is next? Where do we go from here? And so what he does is he repeats the same miracle that he used to call them. I think he's sending a message. It's same song, second verse. The text tells us that when Peter arrived on shore, Jesus said, "Bring me some fish." So he goes over and pulls up the net. I'm assuming he had help, or this is another miracle in the story because the text has just told us they couldn't pull up the net. So Peter walks over and he drags it up on shore and brings some to Jesus. Now why is it significant? Why do you think John takes the time to point out that they ate breakfast? Because this isn't the first time these kind of details are pointed out in the Gospels. Why do some of the Gospel writers note for us that Jesus ate in the aftermath of the resurrection? I mean, that seems like such a mundane thing to discuss. Okay, he had a meal. In fact, you're going to find, for example, when the apostles first saw Jesus, they believed he was a ghost. Now, this is before Thomas showed up. But it was only after Jesus ate a meal in front of them, ate a piece of fish, it was only then that they believed it was really Him. Now that's when they first saw Him. So here in this third appearance by the shore, again he notes that they prepared a meal. Why is that significant? Well, first of all, I just think he tells it because that's what happened. They're gathered around a fire, they're eating a meal together, so he's just telling you details in the story. But we also need to remember that we think that John wrote this gospel near the end of the first century. And as such, he was dealing with a growing belief, a growing false teaching that said that Jesus or the Messiah could not have really become a human being. It went back to this belief that would really flourish in the second century that all human flesh is evil. And because human flesh is evil, you can't have a holy and perfect God becoming what is evil. And so there's no way the Christ, the Son of God, the Messiah, could actually have literally become a human being. It either had to just be the appearance. He kind of looked human, but he wasn't really human. Or some would say he possessed a man, and you know the Christ possessed the man Jesus. And it seems to me that one of the reasons maybe John throws in this detail is to say he wasn't a ghost. It didn't just seem human. He was human, even after the resurrection. I personally think it's just a detail he threw in to deal with a false teaching that was beginning to grow in his day. The recommission. Before we think about what happens next, we need to back up to Matthew chapter 26, verses 31 through 34. Remember, I noted earlier that Jesus had told the apostles before it happened that they would forsake Him. But I want you to notice in particular what Peter says when Jesus said, in essence, "When I'm arrested, you're going to leave me alone." Peter said to Him, "Even though all may fall away because of you, I will never fall away." Okay, now, I want you to understand there are two things, it seems to me, being said by Peter. On the one hand, he's saying, "Lord, I'm not going to let you down when the chips are down." But he's also making a jab at everybody else. He says, "They may all leave you. If all of them leave you, I will not be the one to leave you." Now, what happened? Now, Jesus told him, "No, as a matter of fact, Peter, you're going to deny me three times before the cock crows again in the morning." And that's what he did. And he was, I believe, haunted by that the rest of his life. Matthew tells us when he realized what he had done, he went out and wept bitterly. I think I've told you before, there's a legend that says from time to time, folks who wanted to give Peter a hard time as he walked down the streets of a town would off in the distance crow like a rooster crowing in the morning. Just a little jab. Remember what you did, Peter? Remember what you did? And so I want us to think about that as the background of what happens next. Verse 15 says, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And there are different ways to understand this. You got to figure out who the these is. Okay? Who's he talking about? What's he talking about when he says more than these? Some think he could be saying, do you love me more than the apostles? I don't really picture him saying that. I think that's kind of a given. That's kind of an obvious. I think it would be obvious. Yes, I love you more than the other apostles. More than I love them. Some believe it's possible here that he's saying, you know, do you love me more than these fish? Do you love me more than your old way of life? Do you love me more? You know, you've gone back to fishing. You've gone back to your old way of life. Do you love me more than this? Or do you miss that old life so much you want to go back to it? And I think that's possible. I don't particularly think that's what he's saying. I think as they're sitting around the campfire that morning, maybe Jesus thought about another fire. He thought about a night when Jesus was on trial himself and Peter was warming his hands around the fire in the courtyard of Caiaphas. And somebody said, weren't you with him? You know, you talk just like somebody from Galilee. And three times around that fire, somebody questioned whether he was a follower of Jesus. And three times around that fire, he said no. Having said prior to that, if everybody else forsakes you, I will not let you down. And so I think as they gathered around that campfire that morning, Jesus used it as an opportunity to help Peter grow up. And he said, Peter, do you love me more than these other apostles love me? Because remember, he had said, they may let you down, but I won't. I will be more faithful to you than all of them. So in the aftermath of what he had done, he is saying, do you really love me more than them? And he says, Lord, you know I love you. My guess is, if you've ever looked at this at any time with anybody, you've talked about the difference between the words for love that are used here. I think, to be fair, we need to begin by saying some believe we make too big of a deal of this. Because what happens as you look at the questions, you can hopefully see them up on the screen, three times, I think that's chosen for a reason, because three times he denied and three times he's asked the question. But as he's asked the question, do you love me? Jesus each time is saying, do you agapao me? Now remember, we talked about those words agape and agapao. They were words used in their time, but they weren't used that much. They were relatively unknown and unused words that didn't really have a depth of meaning. And basically what God did when He inspired the New Testament writers to write is He took a fairly colorless and unknown word and gave it a divine meaning. This is selfless, sacrificial love of the will. Before God, that's not what the average person thought when they heard the word on the streets. That's the meaning God gave to it. And that's the meaning that came to be attached to it because it was the word that described God's love. And so three times he says, do you love me? Or twice he says, do you love me with, in essence, a selfless, sacrificial love? That's the idea, if we understand God's definition of the word. And then on those first two times, the response was, I phileo you. That's friendship love and a close love. But it doesn't necessarily have the depth of meaning that the word agape or agapao does. And some would point out a couple of different things. First of all, some would say, hey, we don't even know if this original discussion was in Greek at all. It was likely, some say, in Aramaic. So they didn't even actually use those words. That's just the words Luke used to translate it into Greek so that the people all across the Roman Empire could understand it. That's possible. Though we need to remember that people around Galilee tended to speak Greek a lot more than people down around Jerusalem. They tended to speak Aramaic. People around Galilee tended to speak Greek more. That's why, one of the reasons that the people in Jerusalem kind of looked down on the people up around Galilee. Another thing we need to remember is, even if this conversation took place in Aramaic or Hebrew, a version which is a sister language to Hebrew, we've got to then ask the question, okay, why was it when Luke translated it for us, or John, excuse me, translated it for us, why did John, who was there, who saw the looks on everybody's faces, heard the tone of their voices, why, when he translated it into Greek for us, did John choose two different words if there was no significance to the difference in the words? Some would say that these two words are used quite interchangeably in the Gospels, and they are. At the same time, I find myself saying, why is it then, if they're used so interchangeably, I understand that, but it still doesn't make sense to me why Peter just doesn't respond with the same word Jesus asked with. What's the point of Jesus saying, do you agapao me? I phileo you. Wait a minute. I mean, does that make sense? It just doesn't make sense to me why he would refuse to use the word Jesus used unless he struggled with the idea behind it. You see, he's not the self-confidence guy he was earlier when he says, though everybody lets you down, I won't let you down. Now he's a little bit broken. And when Jesus says, do you love me with a selfless love? Peter remembers what he said. Peter remembers what he did. Peter knows his shortcomings. Peter's just not able to say, yeah, Lord, I'm there. So he says, I love you with a close love like the love of a friend. Peter, do you love me selflessly? Yes, Lord, you know I love you with a close loveness as a dear friend. And finally, Jesus changes the questions and he says the third time, Peter, do you love me with an in-depth love of a dear friend? And Peter says, yes, I do. However you feel about the difference in love, I think Peter is struggling with what he's done. And he's struggling with his commitment and what his real love is. I think he's committed and I think he loves Jesus. He's just a broken man and is not yet ready to say, I love you with an unconditional love because I let you down back in that garden. Now there would be a day coming when I think Peter could say that, but this wasn't that day. And I think Jesus is trying to send a message to him. And after each question, even with Peter's struggle to answer, each time Jesus said something that said, basically, Peter, I still need you. Tend my sheep, feed my lambs, follow me. I think Peter's a hurting and broken man. And Jesus is saying, Peter, remember what you said and what you did and learn from it. Okay, I want you to acknowledge what you've done. But I also want you to realize that is not the end. Winston Churchill said that success is never final. Failure is never fatal. It's courage that counts. Peter, own up to what you've done. That's what he's saying when he asks that question three times. But Peter, move on. I've got work for you to do. And he goes on to talk about the sacrifice that Peter's going to make. And he talks about, you know, when you were young, you went wherever you wanted and did whatever you wanted to do. But he said there's a day coming when somebody is going to lead you where you don't want to go and you will stretch out your arms. And he says it signified what kind of death he would glorify God. And if what tradition passes down to us is true, he was crucified for faith in his Lord. Jesus says, there will come a day when I will see that you do agapao me. There will come a day when you will stretch out your arms and you will die on a cross for me just like I died on a cross for you. As we think about what's going on with these men, the message is same song, second verse. I want us to think about the message that comes across to us. What transition are we at? What is it that we're dealing with? What is it that we have uncertainty about? Maybe it's a success of the past. Maybe it's a failure of the past. Maybe it's just a normal transition of life. And we're saying, what do I do next? I think we can learn some things from what Jesus did with these men. I think we can learn that sometimes to move forward, we've got to come to grips with the past. And so many of us can't get to the future because we're focusing on things we did in the past. And there needs to come a moment when we own up to them, make them right. And there are things that we've held in for years and years and years. And they've kept us up at night. We don't want to talk to anybody else about it. There are things we've done that we felt have betrayed our Lord. And we've held them in for years and they've held us back. And it is time to face up to them. It is time to respond to Jesus' question. How much do you love me? Do I love Him enough to admit I have messed up and that I am sorry and that I will live the rest of my life trying to show Him that I love Him with a selfless love of the will? Some of us may need to face our past to see our future. I think all of us need to learn from our past. And I think that's what He wanted Peter to do. Peter, I forgive you for what you've done. I just want you to walk into the future with a little more humility than you walked into the past. I think not only does He want us to learn from our past, He just wants us to keep following Him. Peter could have become discouraged. I think we're at a critical moment. Where if God beats Peter down too far, He can get into the realm we talked about this morning with fathers. Don't frustrate your children. You see, discipline can go so far that instead of helping a child to understand the need for responsibility and respecting authority and doing right in the eyes of God, that it can make us they can make them bitter against God. And Jesus didn't go there. He was disciplining Peter, but He was saying, Peter, you're one of mine. And I love you. And I need you to keep on following me. And then He says, not only I want you to keep following me, I want you to go right on with the work I originally commissioned you to do. Feed my sheep. Tend my lambs. You guys are all still fishers of men. Nothing has changed. Same song, second verse. I think the message of all this is that Jesus can use broken and uncertain people. And a lot of times there's brokenness and uncertainty that is connected with life's transitions. And Jesus says, I can use those people. Just keep following me. Keep serving me is His message. You know, while we're gathered here tonight, the elites of Hollywood are gathered to get an Oscar. Who will win? Would it be the King's Speech? Will it be Colin Firth to get Best Actress or Best Actor or Natalie Portman to get Best Actress? Who's going to win? Who had the best performance? Who had the perfect performance? You know what gives me hope when I read my Bible? Is that the characters and the actors in the story that God puts forward as examples for me, they don't have perfect performances. They're messed up, broken people. But God made them His Oscar. Because the power was never in the character. The power is in God. And He says, if I can take Peter and make him a star, I can make anybody a star. I've just got to get out of my boat and swim to the shore and say, Jesus, You lead, I'll follow. You give me a job and I'll go do it. Maybe tonight could be a transition for you. Maybe a transition from being outside of Christ to in Christ. Where tonight could be the night that we express our faith in repentance, confession, and baptism and put Him on. Maybe we've been hiding something for too long. We've kept a secret for too long. Tonight could be the night of transition when I own up to it to my God and I start over. If we can help you tonight with a transition, please come. Know that we love you and you're among friends. And that when you come forward, you will not come alone. Please come as we stand and sing.